Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
We've lost track of how long we've been in social isolation, and parents are struggling.
Even parents are regressed in some ways. So chewing on your pen cap really tight, or this high consumption of alcohol that we're seeing.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, April 29th, a look at the challenges parents are facing as many of us hunker down at home during the pandemic. Plus, how a landmark federal case may mean students have a constitutional right to literacy. We also speak with the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, to hear how his city and state are handling the coronavirus. And we round out the show with a tribute to our WNYC colleague who passed away, Richard Hake.
It is really people like Richard who make it, you know, the fireside glow, fireside chat aspect of public radio.
First up, parenting in place. We are many weeks in, sheltering at home to slow the spread of a pandemic, and parenting is getting really tough. It's challenging under normal circumstances, of course, but add to that working from home, plus homeschooling, plus the stressors of living in a pandemic, and it's leaving parents dealing with anxiety, stress, and depression. And we asked you to tell us what the hardest parts of your days are as a parent right now, and where you find moments of joy.
Best part of my day during this whole COVID thing, about 9 o'clock with my 7-year-old daughter, and she just finally lets go of all the worry. She worries all day. Not all day, but, you know, she's got questions and online school and why can't we go there and why can't we go here? It's hard. I'm essential working from home full time. My wife's essential working for a city full time. She's doing 40, 50 hours a week. And we're lying in bed and she's 7 and she finally lets go of all that and just drifts off to sleep and I see the worry just go away.
The hardest part of today was trying to homeschool a frustrated kindergartner who's trying to learn how to spell words while a 3-year-old runs around the house. And the best part of today was waiting with my kids to watch the Blue Angels and Thunderbirds fly over.
Hello, I'm calling from Redmond, Washington. The hardest part of my day today so far was leaving my teenager in an obviously depressed state and my elementary school child with a tummy ache to go to my, quote, essential job. My husband is home with them, but he can't soothe and cuddle as well as mom can.
Hi, this is Patrick calling from Holliston, Massachusetts. Probably the toughest part of every day is just trying to balance my workload. I'm a teacher in Boston, my wife's workload as a therapist, and the needs of my children. The best part of my day today was exploring in the woods with my 3 girls under the age of 6. Their curiosity, their engagement with nature is just so much fun to watch.
Thanks to the many of you who called in with your experiences. We're going to talk a little bit about what parents are going through right now and where they can find help. Cheryl Ziegler is the author of Mommy Burnout, a doctor of psychology, and a registered play therapist. And Jessica Gross is the lead editor of New York Times Parenting. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jess, I want to start with you. Not only are you the lead parenting editor at the Times, but you've got 2 young kids at home. You had a tweet that cracked me up. You said, prepping for homeschooling week whatever. Turns out I don't know what a trapezoid looks like. How's it going over there?
Every day is a challenge. What I like to say is that it's not good days and bad days. It's good 30 minutes and bad 30 minutes. So the mood is shifting rapidly. It's really hard. And I learned over the weekend that I'm not equipped to do preschool math. So that's how it's going.
Cheryl, there are so many different factors contributing to this moment being really hard on parents. What are you hearing?
I would say, you know, we've been through these stages of grief. And what I'm seeing is that initial denial of like, is this really happening? Can I really do this? And then parents feeling like, okay, I could do this short term. But then as the weeks have gone on, it's like, actually, I really can't do this. I'm really over this. And everyone's gone through their stages of being in denial and then being angry and having to find someone or something to be angry at. What I'm seeing really this week right now is a lot of regression. So seeing kids go back to former states that they used to be able to do, you know, potty training, bedwetting, sleeping in their own bed, sucking their thumbs, those kind of things. So I'd say every week we are seeing a different trend in what's happening with kids and families.
Yeah, I mean, Cheryl, we talked on the show yesterday about the pressure to be productive right now and how hard that is living through a pandemic and how much harder it is for parents who are, you know, wearing like 8 different hats right now. How do we see the mental health effects of living during this COVID-19 era play out in parents in particular?
So interestingly, even parents are regressed in some ways. So regression in an adult can look like, you know, chewing on your pen cap really tight, or this high consumption of alcohol that we're seeing. So we're seeing this stress manifest in different ways for parents. And then we're also seeing parents going in and out of these grief stage cycles. And that's what makes it complicated, is that within one family under one roof, you might have people in different stages. So they're experiencing different things and have different needs at the same time. So it is complete and utter overwhelm. We see online counseling services upwards of 200%. We're seeing anxiety medications being prescribed upwards of 30%. And so we're really seeing it happening live, but I also think there's a lot to come in the future.
Jessica, you guys have been writing a lot about how this all looks different depending on income level, just frankly, as parenting did prior to the pandemic. But how does that factor into how this moment feels in different households?
The long-term effects that experts are worried about is really for underserved kids whose parents either they're essential workers or the kids don't have the access they need to online learning. And so there's a lot of fear of them falling behind. There is a lot of fear that is legitimate based on studies that came out of Hurricane Katrina and World War II, that the impact on poorer children might be really severe. I mean, the Times just ran a report today that showed concern for rising obesity rates because kids aren't allowed outside because the school day provides so much natural structure for kids. And that's not just obviously for poor kids, that's for all kids. So I think that we're not even going to know the challenges that we're facing with our kids and our communities until 6 months, a year, 5 years from now.
Cheryl, if you're a parent and you're feeling guilty right now because you've got to work or, you know, you can't give your kid undivided attention, how should you manage that?
Well, I think one of the first things that parents can't hear enough is that they need to lower that bar. And to think that parents are going to be distance learner teachers and they're going to also run the household plus try to keep food on the table, all of that's just not realistic. So I think what I have seen over the last couple of weeks is that that message is starting to get to people. So I would say, you know, get involved in terms of the school. If school does indeed open in the fall, we, you know, advocate for review of everything that was missed in this final quarter. And just know that your kids, if their mental health is really more important, I think, right now than their academic functioning, the fact that they see you as calm, you meaning the parent, they see the parent as calm, managing their own anxiety, taking care of themselves, having some fun and laughter, all of those things are more important right now. I think if a kid can read daily, that's great. That's really important. And, you know, every single kid is different. There are some kids who are kind of thriving in this. There's also the kids that, you know, are on screens all day and that they don't do well with that. There's such a variety. I think that parents just really need to understand that their kids are going to be okay. They are going to catch up. If they need remedial work in the fall, then so be it. But really keeping the household feeling safe and calm, I think, is of utmost priority right now.
How honest should you be about kind of how serious all of this is?
You know, I've been saying from week one that I think we need to be pretty honest with kids, and I haven't changed my stance on that because I think you can communicate depending on the age of the child a little bit differently. But I think it's really important to let them know that we are, I really like saying to kids, you're not stuck at home, you're safe at home, this is a health crisis. It's really important to understand that our actions make a difference, not just for our own lives and our own families, but for everyone around us. And I do think that that's a priority. What I will say this week is teenagers are probably getting the most antsy. And so I'm hearing a lot more of my teen snuck out. My teen wants to see their boyfriend or girlfriend, you know? And so I think they really need to understand the potential health impact of acting upon their impulses right now.
Jess, how does this fall differently on different genders?
We're hearing a lot that it is falling more to moms. And even if the chores and the responsibilities are divided equally, I think moms feel a greater amount of emotional responsibility to maintain the mood of the family and also to keep everything organized and on track. I think they feel a lot of ambient pressure from, you know, they see people posting things on Instagram about their perfect school setup and their kids thriving. And they feel like, well, why does my house look like a disaster area? And I still don't know what a trapezoid is. And so I think that it is overall harder on moms, but I do think it is pretty hard on involved dads as well. It's just not feasible to work and watch your children all day at the same time.
I want to make sure also we're not losing track of the reality that there are a lot of parents who are doing this solo.
You know, I think it is really, really hard on them. They are just taking it day by day, but a lot of them, we were hearing them feeling burnt out weeks ago, you know, from the get-go. Was so overwhelming to have no break, no additional support. I think that is really, really, really tough.
Jess, when we think about potential structural shifts that could come out of this, do you think that it may change the way workplaces think about parenting or even the expectations of parents in terms of what they are able to do kind of with and around their kids?
I'm optimistic about it, actually, which is rare for me. I think just the appearance of children, I mean, dads can't protect their work life in the same way that moms can't protect their work life. So kids are busting in on the Zooms. Dads are getting interrupted in their work the way that moms traditionally have been interrupted in their work. And I think management, which, you know, statistically is still heavily male, are seeing their jobs interrupted and upended by their children in ways that they tend to not, because they're not at home all the time. So I do think that there will be a greater amount of understanding. And there was already a shift among the generation of men who is in their 20s and 30s in terms of how involved they would like to be with their children and how involved they sort of demand their employers to allow them to be with their children. So I am mildly optimistic that this will shift some structural stuff in the workplace in terms of the way employers think about men and women. There's a lot of data that shows when women become pregnant, employers think of them as less engaged and less involved in their work. And I'm hoping that, if anything, that erases that prejudice or at least lessens it a little bit.
Jessica Gross is lead editor of Parenting for the New York Times, and Cheryl Ziegler is author of Mommy Burnout, a psychologist and a registered play therapist. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be hearing more from parents in the coming days. And if you want to tell us about your experience parenting during this time, just give us a call. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. This week, Mississippi joined the growing number of states beginning to reopen their economies. On Monday, Governor Tate Reeves' Safer at Home order went into effect, replacing the state's stricter shelter-in-place order. While retail stores are now able to reopen as long as they maintain half capacity, the order still urges residents to stay at home except for essential travel. In Jackson, Mississippi, Mayor Shokwe Antar Lumumba is handling the logistics of reopening his city. Last week, he also used the emergency powers granted to him during the pandemic to suspend the open carry of firearms in Jackson until April 30th. As we continue with our series of conversations with local leaders about this moment, Mayor Lumumba joins us. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Jackson is both the capital and the densest city in Mississippi. Where are you, do you think, in controlling the spread of the virus there? And what other precautions do you think you need to ensure the safety of your constituents right now?
Well, we're still in the eye of the storm here in Jackson, just like most of the nation. As the governor has issued his safer at home order, it is my intent to continue my stay at home order. You know, not only is Jackson the most dense population and the capital of the state of Mississippi, we are also the capital of healthcare. So the decisions that are made statewide not only impact the city of Jackson, or the decisions we make not only impact the city of Jackson, it impacts the surrounding cities and communities. And so right now, we feel that this order, which allows businesses to go to 50% occupancy under the governor's order, just is not sufficient. And so we will maintain our order, and the governor's order serves as only a minimal standard. And mayors of cities have the ability to provide more restrictive policy.
So what you say supersedes what he says at this moment?
In terms of providing a more strict policy, it cannot be in direct contradiction. So I cannot open up businesses that he has deemed necessary to close, and nor would I want to. But we will continue to see restaurants and bars closed. And in Jackson, retail establishments will be closed, but for those that can provide curbside service.
Are you talking to the governor right now? And has he consulted you at all before making these decisions?
In recent days, we have spoken. He invited me to the governor's mansion for a conversation with about 100 mayors around the state. Through much of this process, I have desired more frequent communication, you know, not because I think that I'm a special mayor out of the bunch, but because the challenges are particularly significant for the city of Jackson, not only due to our size, but due to the fact that the majority of our population is a population that has been disproportionately affected by this virus. Jackson is a 85% African-American community. And the more that we can work in conjunction with the state to use state resources, to use data that the state health department is extracting, is beneficial for us to have a better point of contact approach to the efforts here on the ground.
Yeah, we know from demographics that more people of color in Mississippi have been infected and killed by the virus than white residents. How are you trying to address and mitigate that disparity?
Well, I think that first we have to recognize why that disparity exists. Much of our response to this COVID-19 pandemic has mirrored our healthcare system. We know on an average day in this country, there is great disparities between the access of healthcare for people in Black and Brown communities. And so this pandemic is no different. And so we saw it being necessary to take a proactive approach as a city. So we purchased through the combination of direct purchase and an agreement with the local health care facility, 12,000 tests to be utilized throughout the city. But for us, we believe that testing, while it is important and necessary, it must lead to action. And so we've also purchased what we call a symptom collector that allows people to log their symptoms. It allows our partnership with the healthcare facilities to do a heat map so that we can identify which areas around our city is this virus most prevalent and having a disproportionate effect. And then we can direct resources, direct healthcare, and also through text message alerts, through other forms of outreach, acknowledge to people how serious the pandemic is, and how it is affecting them specifically right there in their neighborhood. We've also purchased, we've also entered into agreement with a local hotel, an agreement which provides convalescence to those who may not have the opportunity to either quarantine because they lack shelter, or the shelter that they do have would put other people in their family in significant danger. We've also you know, attempted to create a hotline for those people to call to be connected to personal health care physicians. And we've created a warm line, which is dedicated to those who are social, who are having mental effects at this time, whether they're feeling anxiety, overwhelmed, or depression. And that line has been utilized quite extensively in the last few days.
We've also seen protests around the country demanding that, you know, different states reopen. And on Sunday, you announced the suspension of open carry of firearms in Jackson until April 30th. Why'd you make that decision?
Well, you know, we have a significant challenge in the city of Jackson as it pertains to illegal firearms. And while I am not opposed to the Second Amendment, a right to bear arms, being a proud gun owner myself, what I do have objection to is the fact that we have limited the tools of law enforcement to determine good from bad, illegal from legal from illegal firearms. What the open carry law does in effect is, you know, guns that used to be able to be seized through plain view, determine the character of those weapons, whether they were legally obtained or illegally maintained, has now been severely hampered in this hour. We've suffered some very unfortunate instances in recent days when we already know that economic pressure is high, emotional tension is high, which is verified by our warm line. This is not the moment that we have tools or, you know, we create an environment which further creates fear and anxiety and trouble. We've had the unfortunate deaths of both a 5-year-old girl who was shot in the head here in the city and a 10-year-old boy within the span of a week. And so I think that as leaders, you know, it's not enough to simply, you know, offer our condolences to mothers and fathers and those people who have lost innocent loved ones to the hands of unnecessary gun violence. I think that we have to research the data, dive in deep, and be prepared to take whatever steps are necessary to protect the life of people.
I absolutely hear you. But at the same time, the Mississippi Attorney General has said you lack the authority, even with emergency powers, to make this suspension. The Mississippi Justice Institute filed a lawsuit on behalf of a state representative against you. How do you respond to their criticism?
Well, it's no surprise that the Attorney General sees it differently than I do. I think that's ultimately a decision or an issue for the courts to determine. As I see the statute as it's written, it absolutely gives me that authority. Maybe the desire was not to provide that type of authority to mayors, but as the statute is written, that's what I see. Furthermore, the individual who has filed claim against the city of Jackson, in my opinion, lacks standing. You know, the situation is not one that has in any way interfered with their rights. They are not an individual who lives in the city of Jackson, nor do they experience the conditions which take place in Jackson. And so, you know, to hold this position and what it proves is that we are more defensive over the idea of a gun than we are the actuality of young people being gunned down in the streets of our city, and not by people who even live in our city, nor confront the challenges that we confront as a city.
You know, this is, as we've been hearing from mayors across the country, a very tough time to be in a position of leadership. And I guess I wonder, how are you doing on a personal level? And what are you doing to take care of yourself right now?
Well, you know, I'm fortunate that, you know, I have the blessing of a loving family. A wife who is supportive of me and many comrades and two little girls that, you know, when I come home from a very long day, you know, run to the door and, you know, are happy to see daddy and, you know, everything happening in the world is pretty much non-existent to them. But we have so many Mississippians who are not similarly positioned that this is creating economic turmoil for them. This is creating emotional and physical, taking an emotional and physical toll on them. And so I think that it is important at this time that leadership not only provide brutal honesty to its constituents, but also provide a rational basis for hope. And so we want people in Jackson, Mississippi, to know that their city is being proactive.
Mayor Chukwe Antar Lumumba is the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
On Tuesday, voters in Ohio finally cast their ballots in the state's primary elections. But instead of heading to the ballot box, voters turned to their mailboxes instead. In the first election of its kind, almost everyone in the state was required to vote by mail. The Ohio primary was supposed to take place last month, but due to COVID-19, hours before the polls opened, the state postponed the election and closed down polls, shifting to mail-in ballots. Ohio is the first state in the country where both parties relied on mail-in ballots for their primary. 21 other states around the U.S. have had to postpone their primaries, including Wisconsin, where we saw in-person polls kept open despite the pandemic. Joining us to walk us through how this process went is Rick Ruan, Ohio politics and government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Hi.
Hi, Lizzie.
Walk us through what we saw right before the March 17th primary date. What was the process like for the state to suddenly shift to postpone the elections?
That process was pretty rushed. So the day before the March 17th primary, Secretary of State Frank LaRose actually had a press conference scheduled in the morning. They canceled it. And later that day, the secretary joined Governor Mike DeWine at his daily press briefing on COVID-19 to tell us that they were taking steps to try to delay the election. When the courts elected not to shut down the election, the governor's administration issued a health order shutting down the polls hours before they were set to open. This is happening at something like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night when polls are scheduled to open at 6:30 the next morning. It was a rushed process, but they ultimately decided to shut it down. And a week later, the Ohio General Assembly came up with its by mail plan.
Do we know yet if the mail-in ballot process was successful?
I guess it depends on your definition of successful. We were expecting a pretty high turnout election this year, given that at the time the presidential primary and on the Democratic side was still up in the air. We have our 16 congressional seats that are up for election in Ohio, and in a heavily gerrymandered state, the primary often serves as the general election. They were predicting historic turnout. When you look at the number of absentee ballots that have actually been cast to this point, and there's still many that could roll in by May the 8th, but we're talking about a 23% turnout.
What were some issues we saw with mail-in voting? What'd you hear from voters?
So voters told us that the mail-in process was extremely slow, and that was reflected and observed by the Secretary of State, who asked at the last minute for help from the state's congressional delegation in dealing with the U.S. Postal Service to speed mail delivery. When they adopted this plan, the expectation was that it would take 1 to 3 days for the different pieces of mail that needed to travel back and forth to make it where they were going. The Secretary of State's letter to the congressional delegation said that they were seeing 7 to 9 day turnaround. Certainly, in a process where you're required to mail in your application, there's no online direct application. The Board of Elections has to receive the application, process it, mail you your ballot back, and then you have to fill out your ballot and either mail it to the Board of Elections or drive to your Board of Elections and drop it off in a drop box. You can see where in a month, if mail delivery is taking 9 days or longer in some cases, that would be a pretty tight turnaround.
Rick Ruan is an Ohio politics and government reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit issued a ruling in a 2016 lawsuit by several Detroit public school students against Michigan state officials. In a 2-1 majority opinion, Judge Eric L. Clay found that the students had their constitutional rights violated when they were denied access to a basic education. And the decision isn't just notable for the city of Detroit. To date, the Supreme Court hasn't weighed in on whether education is a fundamental right in the United States. But the ruling also comes at a challenging moment for public school systems. As states struggle to raise revenue due to the COVID-19 crisis, education funding may take a hit. Joining me now to talk about the Sixth Circuit's decision is Sasha Ryan, an education reporter for WDET. Thanks for joining us, Sasha.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Justin Driver, a professor at Yale Law School and author of The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind. Nice to have you with us as well.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
Justin, the Sixth Circuit ruled that these Detroit students were deprived of a fundamental right to literacy. What factors in the system in Detroit did the majority look at to get to that decision?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And the majority opinion by Judge Clay cited three different factors. The situations in these particular schools in Detroit were really quite egregious. And Clay focused on the teachers, the great amount of turnover, people teaching classes that they were not prepared to teach. Second, he spoke about the facilities, the way that there was extreme heat and extreme cold, and some of these schools had vermin in them, and people would encounter rodent feces, so really egregious facilities. And then finally, the materials themselves. Many of the books were not sort of age appropriate for the students, meaning not the right reading level. And so these factors all culminated along with the demonstrated sort of lack of achievement on standardized tests to suggest that the schools lacked the ability to have a fundamental right of access to literacy.
Sasha, what's the reaction to this decision been from people in Detroit as well as state officials? There's a new government now versus when this case was filed.
There's definitely a lot of excitement and surprise amongst students and educators, education activists, people who've been really paying attention to this case in the hopes that it could affect the quality of education, not only in the city of Detroit, but throughout Michigan. The government's response is really kind of interesting. We're waiting to see how the governor responds. She's now the named defendant in the case, but this started under a Republican governor before her. And so to see if she decides to continue to fight this case or looks for some kind of settlement, we don't really have a sign yet for how she's going to handle this.
You know, Sasha, I spent some time with one of the plaintiffs in this case back when this was filed, and he told me some horror stories about conditions in the schools. How much have conditions changed, if at all, since this was filed in 2016?
I would say there have been really big changes in Detroit schools since then. This case was filed just as the state was releasing control of Detroit city schools. So after this, the Detroit Public Schools actually would cease to exist as the district that was educating students. And so now we have the Detroit Public School Community District, which was created by the state as a new district to educate students, while Detroit Public Schools exist as an entity only to pay the debts that grew under state control. So there's a new school board superintendent who have local control of the schools and have really done a lot of work to turn academics around, to balance the budget, to change the culture in the schools. And so we do see significant changes, but we still see a lot of the damage done under state control that has to be fixed. So while we have academic progress, it's really just a little bit of academic progress.
Justin, the Supreme Court has never issued a ruling on whether a basic education is a fundamental constitutional right. But when we think about potential precedent for the Sixth Circuit's decision, what is important to think about here?
There are a couple of major Supreme Court cases that Judge Clay interacts with. The first is a case from 1973 called San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez, which involved a lawsuit suggesting that students in poor areas received inadequate funding in comparison to students in property wealthy areas. And the Supreme Court rejected that claim and made a big deal out of the fact of saying, well, there was no absolute deprivation here. It was only a relative deprivation. The court encountered another case, Plyler versus Doe, which was decided in 1982, also out of Texas. And there, Texas sought to exclude unauthorized immigrants from public schools. And the Supreme Court invalidated the Texas measure, said you cannot exclude these people. And one of the things that loomed large in the court's analysis was that to exclude children from school altogether would be to turn them into a subclass of illiterates. And so in a significant sense, you can understand this recent decision as saying that in effect, the children who are attending these Detroit public schools are very much in the legacy of the students who had been absolutely excluded from schools in Texas. And the Supreme Court had entertained the idea about there being an inadequate education, so inadequate as to amount to a constitutional violation. And here, in the face of egregious facts, Judge Clay found such a violation.
One of the things that seems important here, though, is that this is about due process, that this is a floor sort of establishing, I guess, even access to participating in the economy rather than an equal protection case, both different parts of the 14th Amendment. How would that apply potentially to other states with, you know, similarly troubled school systems?
Yeah, that is going to be an important question going forward, because the facts on the ground in these particular schools in Detroit were so abysmal. You could imagine people in other cities in the face of struggling schools, but perhaps not as struggling as these particular schools in Detroit, bringing these sorts of claims, and other panels or other judges saying, yeah, things are not perfect in these schools, but they are not as bad as Detroit. And so that could serve to limit the applicability of the case. And the challenge for lawyers who seek to bring these sorts of claims would be to say, no, these schools do bear a rather strong similarity to the Detroit public schools in question.
Sasha, the kids in question here are primarily Black and Latino. State control for a while was resting with the state government, led largely by white people in Lansing. How has race been discussed when it comes to state control of the school system, and what happens now?
I think race has always been one of the big issues in this discussion. Definitely, Detroit public schools are largely Black schools. It's a largely Black city. It's a very poor city and a very poor school district. The idea that people were coming in from outside of the city and judging the city and Black governance in the city, which is essentially what the state would have replaced, is a big deal. And the idea of restoring Black governance has been really important, I think, to the morale of the district. State control in Michigan, however it looked, whether it was emergency management or, you know, financial oversight, has been largely put in place in Black and brown communities. Detroit wasn't the only school district. Detroit wasn't the only city that had state control. Some Black and brown cities in Michigan have lost their public schools completely. So race has been a really, really big part of this discussion.
You know, all of this is happening, Sasha, in the backdrop of COVID-19. How have students in Detroit fared doing remote learning? And does more money for the public school system in Detroit even seem possible in the middle of this crisis?
It's a great question. So there's a vast digital divide here between students in the city and students outside of the city or students in surrounding suburbs. Our school district moved really quickly to provide physical packets to support at-home learning, even while also really pushing the state to acknowledge that whatever happens educationally right now cannot count. It's got to be considered enrichment because they're, you know, because I don't know, I'm a parent. Like, what can you expect from parents? So that happens. Last week, the city school district received funding from businesses and philanthropic organizations to provide tablets and internet access to students, to all of the students in the district, in the hopes of being able to even provide just that enrichment to keep students engaged and in a position where they could possibly learn things before returning to the classroom whenever that happens. But it's a really kind of chaotic mix, and a lot of the responsibility has fallen on teachers to check in individually with students, to call all of the students in the district and just find out what's going on, how they're doing, how their families are doing, and if they are learning at home. And I don't think we really have a good sense for what's happening in homes and what kind of learning is getting done. And I don't think we will until we do get back into the classroom.
Sasha Ryan is an education reporter for WDET, and Justin Driver is a professor at Yale Law School. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This week, The Takeaway and WNYC, our home station in New York City where we're produced, lost a friend and beloved coworker. Richard Hake died in his home from natural causes at age 51. He was the Morning Edition host on WNYC, and before that, he was the local anchor of The Takeaway since the very beginning of the show in 2008. Here's his voice from our very first show, 12 years ago yesterday.
This is WNYC. Good morning. I'm Richard Hake, and it's our new news program, The Takeaway. Morning Edition can be heard on AM 820, also at 7 o'clock this morning right here on 93.9. In local news, the Sean Bell case is still making headlines this Monday morning. Relatives spoke out about
here at the station, Hake was a mentor to many, a leader in the newsroom, and at the front line of the union, where he worked as a shop steward for years. Most of our Takeaway team, from producers to board operators to hosts, has worked with and learned from Richard. For listeners, he was a voice of comfort and reassurance during uncertain times. And many of you may have a Richard Hake in your own communities and can relate to the special place of a morning news host in our daily lives. I spoke with Shamita Basu, a reporter, host, and producer for WNYC News, and Arun Venugopal, also a reporter and host for WNYC, who have both guest-hosted here on The Takeaway. And Arun worked alongside Richard in the newsroom for nearly 15 years. I asked him why audiences felt so connected to Richard.
He's this great-looking guy. I mean, he's like, you know, like a 1950s, like, movie star, and is sort of dashing, and I think when you first experience that, you would think like, oh, he's this intimidating presence. And the reality is that he had this incredible ability to make you feel at ease. He was very at ease in his own skin. He had this kind of like warmth in his voice, and he had this warmth in his body language and just a naturalness that made you feel like you were going to be taken care of. There's an alchemy in that process that draws you out from being like, oh, I've got these facts and figures that people need to know, to something different, to saying like, oh, he's excited, and you kind of forget about the rest of the world. And I think that's what really kind of entranced people at home. And a lot of that you take for granted when you go through like day after day of listening to public radio. It's just your routine. It's just something you just kind of take for granted. I think it is really people like Richard who make it that kind of, you know, the fireside glow, the fireside chat aspect of public radio.
Shamita, you know, he also helped train you to sit in the big chair and build rapport with a huge audience. His audience was the biggest of any during the day on WNYC. What do you think it takes to make that connection with an audience and have them think of you as their radio friend?
Oh, Richard was so good at that. I think it's a combination of things. One thing that Richard was so, so good at was making the listeners feel like he was just speaking to them. It's just you and him at the table in the kitchen, and you don't have to say anything. Don't worry. Keep drinking your coffee. He's going to tell you everything. He'll tell you the news. He'll tell you the weather. He'll tell you how to dress before you step out the door that day. And that's very intimate. And when you recognize that intimacy as the host, as the speaker of those words, that unlocks this ability to deliver it in that intimate way. Richard was so good at that, at sort of recognizing the singularity of the listener.
Yeah, and I think he knew that it wasn't enough to be just some sort of, abstract idea of the perfect informed and informing personality. You know, like his willingness to kind of reveal and a little bit of himself, to be curious, to be surprised by things. I mean, there's this great sort of like tape going around the last couple of days in these tributes of Richard riding, you know, the roller coaster at Coney Island. And you can just kind of hear him screeching.
Tape. It's wonderful.
Okay, here we are on the world-famous Cyclone, built in 1927. It's now celebrating its 70th birthday, and we're on the way up, 85 feet above the Atlantic Ocean and Coney Island. Here on my right as we go up, I can see the Verrazano Narrows Bridge and the Manhattan skyline, and here we go. It says remain seated because we're at the big drop, 85 feet, here we go!
It is so amazing because it just, this screech, from this, serious newscaster kind of guy or whatever, nothing, not at all that kind of person, of course, but, what could have been this very serious and sort of this automaton of a presence. He was a human and funny in those little ways, just enough to make you feel like, oh, this is going to be fun. You're going to spend time with each other and this city, that he loves so much. There's so much pleasure to be taken in the city and with each other, really.
I want both of you to tell us just a little something you want people to take away from this. People who may not know of Richard, or maybe they have someone who's sort of their own Richard Hake at their home station. What should people take away from Richard's life and career? What do you want them to walk away from this remembrance thinking about?
He leaves behind a legacy of such professionalism and camaraderie. He was a person who could have just done either of those things really well, but he did them both so well. He was exceptionally great at what he did as a broadcaster, and he was also exceptionally great to his colleagues around him. And both of those things are things that I think a lot of us have learned from in the newsroom and have changed the DNA of our newsroom. So it changed the way that we are good to each other and check in with each other.
Lizzie, some of us have known each other a long time and have worked at WNYC or in public radio longer than anywhere else we've worked. And there's a reason for that, I think. And it's because there are people like Richard, who do ask, as Shumita said, how's it going? How are you? Who show you that they care and are invested in you. And I think what's made it painful, this experience very sad for a lot of us, is that, we couldn't be there for him. It has been really nice. I think the fact that we've all been reaching out to each other and remembering Richard and better times. And it's also very painful. And I think for me, it's also, it's an occasion to kind of ask, at moments like this, who are we to one another? What is our responsibility? What do we owe each other? And does all this end as soon as normal, whatever that means, comes back, So I think if there's one question I'm asking myself is, when we remember Richard, how do we do right by him? And how can we be there for one another?
Arun Venugopal and Shamita Basu are reporters and hosts for WNYC and longtime friends and colleagues of Richard Hake, the WNYC Morning Edition host who passed away last week at the age of 51 of natural causes. Shamita, Arun, thank you so much for this tribute and for just taking the time to talk about Richard with me.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Arun, sending you love. Thanks, Lizzie.
Back to you. Thank you, Shamita. And bye, Lizzie. Thanks so much.
Richard Hake was part of this show's extended family. We offer our condolences to his loved ones, which include our colleagues here at WNYC and all who are grieving during this time. And on a related note, Shamita Basu will be hosting The Takeaway starting next week for the last month of Tanzina Vega's maternity leave. Thanks so much for listening today and every day. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is The Takeaway.